Hello and welcome back, my friends. I hope you all had a lovely holiday reprieve, are staying warm, and are prepared for a new year of freedom fighting. We'll start this week's broadcast with the uncertain fate of President Biden's Build Back Better agenda. After a deal between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and vital Democratic holdouts from the Progressive Caucus moved the bill narrowly through the House, it now looks dead on arrival in the Senate. As we first reported several months ago, Manchin has always been likely to derail the bargain, which entailed House Democrats passing the bipartisan infrastructure bill in exchange for Senate Democrats agreeing to subsequently pass the Build Back Better agenda. Manchin's December 19th disavowal of the bill via Fox News is already creating backlash within the Democratic Party. According to a representative from the office of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, should Biden run again in 2024, he will face a certain progressive challenger in the primaries. This should alarm Democrats, as Biden, who campaigned in the general election as a moderate, prepared to reconcile between Democrats and Republican concerns, seized on his narrow majorities to try and enact major and controversial reforms. As Michigan House Republican Pete Meyer said on NBC's Meet the Press this past week, Biden received no clear mandate for a radical transformation of American governments. He was a compromise candidate who eked out narrow wins in key states to win the Electoral College. Trying to cater to minority constituencies within his party, he put all his political capital into a deal that now looks all but dead. His promises to continue to try and work with Manchin aside, it isn't clear what more can be accomplished after months of public and private arm-twisting, posturing, and negotiations. Assuming the bill fails, the results for Democrats will be disastrous. With midterms looming, internecine conflict begins. Already in the wake of unexpectedly meager majorities produced by the 2020 elections, Democrats were quick to point the finger at one another. On one side, the Progressive Caucus, led by Washington Representative Premia Jayapal, believed Democrats needed to distinguish the party by embracing policies like the Green New Deal, defund the police, and taxing the 1%. While on the side, moderate Democrats of the New Democrat Coalition, chaired by Washington Representative Suzanne Delbean, seek to hew to a more traditional line on taxes, spending, the budget, and regulation. Their feud spilled out into the open and onto social media, and a drubbing this November promises more of the same. Indeed, setting any inter-party politics aside, the Biden administration desperately needs passage of this bill. With less than a year to the elections, he and his party's accomplishments are few, the signs of trouble are everywhere. As things stand now, with Congress returning from their winter recess, the ranking Senate Democrat Chuck Schumer of New York has promised a vote on the bill at some point early in January. Also expected in January, the Supreme Court will rule on the Biden administration's vaccine mandate. So far, the Supreme Court has upheld a variety of state vaccine mandates. Here, however, the question turns on whether or not Congress has authorized the executive branch to institute such requirements. Tellingly, the Supreme Court has already struck down Biden's mandate on eviction moratoriums, suggesting the six-justice conservative majority will likely strike down the administration's wide-ranging coronavirus vaccine mandate. Politically, the Biden administration would be better off dropping the fight. It is politically unpopular among a significant portion of the electorate and difficult to defend in the face of what is clearly a mild strain of disease and waning efficacy of the prescribed vaccines. To borrow a line from Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. Rising inflation is unlikely to be curbed anytime soon by prospective resolutions in existing supply chain difficulties, and the disruptions caused by high turnover in key sectors such as nursing over vaccine mandates is arguably as harmful to the economy as any damage done by the virus itself. Almost as a rule, the government cure to a problem is worse than the disease. Vote Libertarian. A recent poll conducted by Public Agenda and USA Today Nearly 3 of every 4 Americans said it would be good for the country if Americans, quote, reject political hostility and divisiveness and focus more on their common ground, end quote. Despite the seeming agreement, it is clear that the majority of those surveyed also think this won't happen, as fewer than 1 in 10 surveyed think political rancor between ordinary Americans will decrease in the next 10 years, compared to nearly half who think it will increase. Among the survey's key findings, 1. Nearly 3/4 of Americans, 72%, think it would be good for the country if Americans reject political hostility and focus more on areas of mutual agreement. Those identifying as Democrats, 75%, or Republicans, 80%, were even more inclined to agree with that sentiment. 2. Only 9% of Americans think that political rancor between ordinary Americans will decrease in the next 10 years. A 42% plurality thinks it will increase, led both by Republicans and independents, each at 46%. 3. 4 in 10 Americans, including 52% of Republicans, believe it would be good if a strong, charismatic leader gains power and is willing to do whatever it takes to maintain control and run the country in the way he or she thinks is best. And more than half, 53%, believe that will happen within the next decade. 4. 3 in 10 Americans have very unfavorable feelings toward either Republican or Democratic voters. This includes 18% who view GOP voters that way and 13% who feel the same about Democratic voters. 5. Despite the increasing political acrimony, most Americans reject the notion of splitting the country into red and blue states, with 51% saying it would be very bad and 19% saying it would be somewhat bad. 6. About 3/4 of Americans say they value different political perspectives, and nearly half, 45%, say that in the past 12 months, they have often or sometimes had a constructive conversation about politics with someone holding opposite political views. The problem, despite the sentiment, Americans don't seem to be willing to embrace an attitude of live and let live, and instead focus on the imposition of their own preferences. As one of the participants, Phil Wesson, noted, "I don't believe that everybody wants to get together. I think everybody wants to get together as long as they agree with my position," end quote. Unity seems to be the goal, but only under a set of rules and values that should be imposed on those who disagree. Despite the call to unity, American politics remains an ideologically divided circus, with leaders and political diehards demanding obedience to their rules and their vision. This can in part be blamed on the increasing division and rancor of officials of the state. The hostility between Democrats and Republicans is increasing, and COVID has further distanced those of libertarian and authoritarian mindsets. Such division can't help but intrude into daily lives. Public feuds between national office holders who are supporters of former President Donald Trump and their moderate to progressive counterparts affect the lives of everyday people, said Sukaparche Stevenson, 26, a paralegal from Nashua, New Hampshire, who participated in the survey. "My friends and I were discussing the Rittenhouse trial. Some were saying that it was a sham." Stevenson, a self-described independent, said he was accused of being a right-winger for pointing out misinformation in the Rittenhouse trial. "We have since cleared the air on that and made some more sense, but it was very disheartening to see that happen among your friend group," he said. Unsurprisingly, much of the anger is focused on former President Donald Trump and overly simplistic understandings of politics and political action. Barbara Brown of Burlington, Kentucky said, quote, "I blame it all on Trump, and I think he wants to be king. He doesn't believe in the democratic government. He wants all the power, and he wants another civil war. He's turning people against each other," end quote. While not a rational interpretation of the former president and overly simplistic in its interpretation, sources of division, it is representative of current hardline views. Bill Doherty, a family therapist and University of Minnesota social science professor, promotes civil discourse among politically divided citizens and lawmakers. He said political rancor existed long before Trump, which is why it persists nearly a year after he left the White House. And he said it's been fueled by leaders in Washington who use social media to amplify division, build attention, and boost fundraising. Despite his own misgivings, Doherty remains hopeful. Quote, the beginnings of change is naming a problem, and it's good news that Americans believe we are too divided because when you name it, we can start to ask the question, how would we become less divided? As opposed to simply asking the question, how can we make the other side wake up and see what they're doing, end quote. Doherty may be onto something, but in an age of political absolutism, when the opposition is utterly evil and one's own sides are the heroes, standing in the way of ruin, what is the incentive to move away from asking the second question and moving to the first? The message we receive on the state of the nation's political unity is clear. A majority seem to favor it, but on their own ideological terms. While Americans desire unity, the often unspoken implication is that it must be done in a way that meets their desires and ignores the contradictory desires of their neighbors. The unity desired is one of ideological imposition and authoritarianism, but the nation is so divided that it is difficult for either side to ever claim victory and impose their political vision on the rest. This in turn leads to increased hostility among the population who take sides and likewise view those who hold opposing views as evil. Oversimplification of this division is perhaps most evident in the national divide over Donald Trump, who was lauded as a savior by some and aspiring tyrant by others, though the truth is that he is neither. The great man theory of history, originally conceived by Thomas Carlyle, accounts for this irrational propensity of individuals to describe great power to highly influential individuals who spearheaded a decisive historical effect. People seek leaders who will do the dirty work of shaping the world, including blood and impression, to suit them. Those leaders, in return, are made symbols and deities, encapsulating the virtuous aspect of what their followers desire. This trend towards authoritarianism and dictatorship should be very concerning to libertarians, as it seems 4 out of 10 Americans hope this is realized in the next decade. The other notably disheartening statistic for the freedom-minded is that most Americans reject the notion of splitting the country into red and blue states, with 51% saying it would be very bad, and 19% saying it would be somewhat bad. Though not explicitly stated, one can presume that this means a continuation of violence, enforced unity with possibilities of secession and decentralization off the table entirely. This is terrible for several reasons. Firstly, the notion of undeniable unity keeps the nation firmly on course for the predicted increased political division and violence, much like a couple that despises each other but refuses to separate or divorce on religious principle. The only way such a relationship can function is if one party is willing to concede nearly everything. Such a notion is very poor for individual rights, but is also unlikely to happen. Secondly, it is inevitable that both human rights and diversity suffer in the wakes of inflexible nationalism. If the maintenance of United States unity should trump all considerations, then any and all concerns to the contrary will be quashed. Regional concerns will die in the face of collective interest, and minorities will always be exploited by the majority without recourse to action if unity is more desirable than liberty. There is one encouraging statistic here, and that is that 3 in 10 Americans have very unfavorable feelings toward either Republican or Democratic voters, 18% who view GOP voters that way, and 13% who view the same way about Democratic voters. Those who share unfavorable views of both, and by extensions the ideologies of both parties, are potential allies and members of the Liberty Tribe, the tribe for those who value the voluntary and peaceable interaction over socio-political uniformity. The trick is how to convince such people that an individualistic tribe is really a tribe, and one worth joining, especially given that the other current tribes will react violently to a rejection for unity. we can potentially be heartened by the notion that three-quarters of Americans say they value different political perspectives, but this is not the same as respecting another individual's actual choices for their life. The conundrum freedom followers are left with is clear. Hatred and division between the two, authoritarian ideologies that vie for control of the lives of this country, will continue to rise, despite the supposed desire for reconciliation and unity, because neither side can concede to conditions that don't see their views imposed upon others. Doing nothing ensures that we will either be trapped in this cycle, or that one will eventually snuff out the rights that don't suit them. The answer is to take advantage of the disharmony, utilize it to grow members, numbers, and reject impositions on liberty from both, and work towards the primary goal, that one day the liberty-minded can have a place of their own. Remember, the more the statists refuse to play nice with each other, the more they fracture their system, and more likely the kind of political division and breakdown needed to create a real home for libertarianism becomes. In a recent editorial in The Hill, opinion contributor Brad Banning joined the throngs of progressives who have come to exaggerate the intent and impact of the events at the Capitol on January 6, 2021. The language is itself notable because it is not about democracy, but about partisan domination through the existing system, the system which secures their increasingly inflexible edicts of the public regardless of consent. Bannon begins by saying, "The darkest political day of 2021 came early, on only the sixth day of the year. It was the day that democracy almost died. The Republic survived, but just barely. Democracy isn't dead yet, but it's on life support, and Republicans seem intent on putting it out of its misery," end quote. Note that Bannon's language immediately vilifies not only those protesting and rioting that day, but the opposing party in entirety. He also exaggerates the threat to the system he adores for its ability to impose his values and desires on the populace as a whole. Bannon continues to address the basic causes of the protests, the unclear nature of the presidential election of 2020, and the increasingly partisan divide that destabilizes his precious democracy. The notion of anything but subservience to the majority never enters the discussion, nor is there any culpability for the actions of those on the left, for fostering such disunity, or the harm caused by protests for progressive causes. The blame is entirely laid at the feet of those Bannon thinks of as the right. Quote, "It's easy to identify but not justify the source of the desperation that led right-wing extremists to turn to violence. The Republicans are sore losers. The GOP has only won the popular vote once in the last six presidential elections going back to 2000. That was back in 2004. The party's unpopularity has forced it to rely on one of the most undemocratic features in the Constitution, the Electoral College, to retain its slippery hold on the White House," said Bannon. Bannon goes on to lament what he believes to be attacks on democracy, though it is more aligned with his own party's ability to win elections than represent the voting populace. Quote, "After Republican governors and state legislators pushed an aggressive and regressive effort to make it more difficult for voters to elect Democrats. A study by the Brennan Center for Justice in May indicated legislators in 48 states have filed 389 bills to restrict voting rights. The GOP approach to elections appears to be, if you can't beat them at the polls, then cheat them out of their votes. The party has decided to destroy democracy rather than embrace it," end quote. Note, he shows no actual evidence this will prevent Democrats from securing votes, and fails to note that much of this is aimed at maintaining proof of citizenship when voting. Bannon's opinion is firmly rooted in the idea that his side is right, and the majority, and as such, should dominate the political landscape, regardless of consent. This anger at potential loss of power is the clarion call for all authoritarians. The notion that power is legitimized by majority and subsequent violence of the state. It lauds itself as blameless in the political divide, while exaggerating the severity of circumstances and demonizing its opponents. The circumstances of January 6th are certainly rooted in complex feelings and responses to a declining America, but ultimately are rooted in a corrupt and authoritarian system. The author lauds the increased prevalence of democracy in this country as the greatest political circumstances that can occur, but democracy is not freedom. Despite the desire of those who value the validation of force on the part of the state to satisfy themselves by claiming they have the consensus, consensus is not consent. Majoritarians, of which the progressive left is the best existing example in modern America, has no regard for individual rights, only the societal imposition of their will based on winning elections in one of the most overly complex, divisive, and corrupt political systems that currently exist. They engage in extraordinary hypocrisy when they accuse the right of being abusive, authoritarian, and fascist because they themselves engage in such behaviors on a consistent basis. It is only the facade of democracy as a justification for such actions that shields them from equitable criticism. This is not to say the American right, the strident conservatives, are necessarily any better. The movement has shown it is willing to forgo natural rights and the dignity of freedom, being on the wrong side of numerous civil liberties issues in the last century. Indeed, much of the pushback has been a response to the slow loss of popularity it saw in the 80s. That being said, it should be recognized that both sides are ultimately determined to win popularity contests, which allow them to determine the basic human rights of millions of people, and this is the real problem. When January 6th occurred, there were a few basic types who were vocal, though, who felt it was addressing corruption in a system they hoped to control, those who were angry at potentially losing control of that system, and those who saw this as an indictment against a failed system that was demonstrating both its true authoritarian nature and inability to maintain any real harmony in its opposing factions. Most freedom-loving people were of the third mindset, and rightfully so. While it has occasionally been said that libertarianism should illustrate a moderate or middle-of-the-road faction, one able to accommodate compromises and the best aspects of both parties, I would condemn this as both patently false in its expression of the idea of liberty and a shallow attempt to placate those who hate the notion of individual sovereignty. Libertarianism should be anything but moderate or compromising. It should ardently place the rights of the individual above all things and decry not just the flavors of authoritarianism offered in the current political divide, but the system that they war over. A system that feels the tyranny of the majority is of more value than the rights of the individual. The truth is that democracy has little value to those that love freedom. It is another brand of oppression, and has never deserved the accolades heaped upon it by Western scholars. The shift towards increased democratization will only create underclasses and oppressed minorities based on political and economic interest. It will crush creativity, devalue skill and hard work under the wheel of a human equity that has never been real. The only valuable equality is that of the recognition of individual human rights, and as such, the great failure of America has never been lack of governance or citizen participation in such systems. Its failure has been the inability to recognize that human rights are not negotiable based on sentiment or race or gender or any of the other myriad of things that humans use to divide themselves from their neighbors. We don't need more strangers making rules for their neighbors. We need more individuals who are not prohibited from making their own choices and directing their own lives. The Satanic Temple, a secular organization who uses the protection of the First Amendment to challenge religious orthodoxy in America, turned heads again last week with a new holiday display in the rotunda of the Capitol building in Illinois. Currently sitting beside a traditional Christian nativity display is one honoring the symbolic figurehead of the organization, Baphomet. For those unaware of the history, the Baphomet is a figure, usually depicted as an anthropomorphic goat, sometimes with wings, that is seen as the embodiment of the concept of the Lightbringer, gifting knowledge. The specific concept itself dates back to the early 14th century, when the Knights Templar were accused of worshipping Baphomet as part of a smear campaign undertaken by Philip IV of France and his chief minister, Guillaume de Nogaret. due to the heavy indebtedness of the French crown to the wealthy monastic order, like the Templars themselves and the eponymous Friday the 13th, which saw the arrest and torture of many of that order, Baphomet has always carried a certain reputation. The figure again rose to prominence during the intellectual and spiritual revolution of the late 19th century, where it has been associated with numerous spiritualist movements, esoteric orders, and even notorious figures of alternative religions like the infamous Aleister Crowley. In this respect, the current 21st century incarnation is less interesting, but no less important. For many activists, Baphomet stands in opposition to the state-assisted hegemony of Christianity in the Western world, a reminder of the centuries of persecution of other faiths, and a weapon against state imposition of religion in the United States. While generally thought of as eccentric and harmless by much of the United States, those who desire a heavy Christian influence via the mechanism of the state tend to be deeply angered by such displays, which is very much the point of the Satanic Temple's actions. This is the third year of such displays in the Illinois Capitol, but this one seems to have aroused the most ire, excepting the statue intended for display in Oklahoma in 2014 that was eventually located in Detroit in 2015. The new outrage seems to be the nature of the display, a statue of an infinite Baphomet similar to descriptions of Jesus Christ in nativity scenes. This piece, titled Baby Baphomet, is unlike earlier displays which tended to be more symbolic and emphasize the ideas of peace and knowledge shared universally, and tends to be more of a direct comparative to their Christian counterparts. Additionally, the Satanic Temple displays tended to be less prominent when compared to their mainstream competitors. Neither the softness of messaging or lack of attention seem to have happened this year, and this has the local diocese in an uproar. The Springfield Diocese, which installed its nativity scene in the rotunda of the Illinois State Capitol on November 30th, rejects the Satanic Temple's claim that the baby Baphomet is a message of harmony, reconciliation, and unity, and a display of positive values. Bishop Thomas Paparocki of the Springfield Diocese says that there is no place for satanic displays in the Capitol or anywhere else, and generally questions the legitimacy of non-Christian displays. Indeed, many of his congregations have gone a step further, going out of their way to protest the presence of the baby Baphomet and harass Satanic Temple members, who have been met with threats and signs like Stop Blasphemy Now, Satan Has No Rights, and Begone Satan, Mary Crushes the Serpent. While the display is no doubt causing some friction, a sign accompanying both religious displays in the Capitol Rotunda reads, "The state of Illinois is required by the First Amendment of the United States Constitution to allow temporary public displays in the state capitol so long as these displays are not paid for by taxpayer dollars. Because the first floor of the Capitol Rotunda is a public place, state officials cannot legally censor the content of speech or displays. The United States Supreme Court has held that public officials may legally impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions regarding displays and speech, but no regulation can be based on the content of the speech," end quote. This protection of First Amendment rights seems to confirm the statement made by Satanic Temple's Illinois minister. The Capitol welcomes a diverse range of religions every year to display holiday statues during the holiday season, so we wanted to join in on that. The issue on hand is one of religious freedom, a natural right, and one supposedly protected by the First Amendment and numerous state constitutions as well. Much like freedom auditors use their rights to confront abusive law enforcement and corrupt officials, so does the Satanic Temple push those in power to ensure that religion remains a personal choice and not a function of the state. Auditors of religious freedom, if you will, keeping the state of the business out of the business of endorsing some form of Christianity as politically favored or surreptitiously official. Some will argue that this is a form of mockery, and perhaps this current display is not as good-natured as previous displays, but it still serves the function of forcing the state to acknowledge non-Christian religion displays and practices. This is an important reminder to both the state and intolerant individuals like Bishop Paparocki that faith is a matter of personal conscience, and that freedom-loving people will not tolerate state faiths or preferential treatment of religion. Religious freedom is woven into the fabric of our nation. Many of our founders were deists who worked side by side with Protestants to ensure that religious choices were left up to the individual, where such choice always belongs. Europe, in which national churches and national faiths were common, has seen a dramatic decline of faith in the last century. Increasingly, Europeans identify as secular, ignoring their state-controlled church systems. For many in European nations, there are only two options, conventional religion or secularism. This is not so in the United States, where religious freedom and division between faith and government have become commonplace. Here we enjoy broad religious diversity and deep religious conviction because it is precisely the lack of state intervention that allows for both. In short, the libertarian view on faith. We favor the freedom to engage in or abstain from any religious activities that do not violate the rights of others. We oppose government actions that either aid or attack any religion. Has created more harmony amongst diverse religious and groups and allowed for more deeply held faith in that diversity than seen almost anywhere else in the world. While the Satanic Temple may sometimes be tacky and is itself a secular ideology, its stand on religious freedom do far more for both the freedom to choose and the freedom to practice than many conventional religious organizations do. For defending that freedom, anyone of faith and any secularist should be grateful. That is all for today's broadcast. Before I go, I would like to apologize for the gap since our last episode. I spent a lot of time crafting that message and needed the holiday break, and then my unvaccinated ass got COVID and spent an additional week on the mend. But I am back to form now, and I'm looking forward to bringing you a new year full of regular content. If you support what I am doing on this podcast, please join the Libertarian Party of Michigan or send us a special donation at michiganlp.org/donate. Thank you for your time, my friends, and stay free.